Education, E-12 Education Finance Division will come to order, and we do have a quorum. So we will start with Senate File 274, which is Senator Saxhog's proposal. And members, you have before you the fiscal notes for the three bills that we'll be hearing on early childhood this morning. And I would just make mention before we get started here that we have quite a number of bills relating to early childhood programs that are in the division. And we won't be hearing all of the proposals, but we will be hearing all of the we will be covering all of the individual aspects of early childhood so that we have all of the information as we put together the proposals for early childhood. And so as we go through, we will be, as we talked earlier, we had Senator Clark's proposal on early childhood, and today we'll hear several others. And then tomorrow evening, Wednesday evening at 6 p.m. in this room, we will be hearing 107, I'm sorry, across the hall. We will be hearing the an array of legislation relating to special education. And there, too, we have a whole number of proposals relating to special education. And so we'll try to cover the full spectrum relating to all the different facets of special education as we start to compile the omnibus education finance bill. Finally, we do have, and if anyone's confused, don't worry. We will try to address everybody's concerns. We do have before us an amendment relating to Senate File 274. And Senator Saxhog, maybe you want to move that amendment to get it before you, if that's what you'd like.
I would, Mr. Chair. I'd move the A1 amendment.
Okay, Senator Saxhog moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 274. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Then I would ask members, as you look at your fiscal note and the amendment, I believe the fiscal note, if you look on the fiscal note on page 5 and 6, or actually page 2, yeah, page 5, just so we kind of all start from the same footing here. On page 5, under section 2, where, the area there under expenditure and or revenue formula, under section 2, I believe the first three items, the one that starts the 1.0 FTE education specialist, the second one, the clerical and salary and benefits, and the third one, the kindergarten assessment data. Those, I believe, are out of the amendment that was just adopted. And I could stand to be corrected, but that's my information, is that those components are no longer in the delete all amendment. Okay. With that, we'll hear about... our fiscal analyst is working on a new total, but I don't think that's going to change a whole lot. But Senator Saxhog, welcome, and welcome to your guests.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As Kevin McHenry said, it's a pleasure for me to be able to set the table for early childhood and the different proposals that we're going to have. Before I ask a couple people to come up here and explain the actual bill, Senate File 274, With me today at the table are a couple of people from Grand Rapids and Itasca County who have been instrumental in working on early childhood and, in fact, have been the model for the legislation that we're talking about. With me today is Jim Houlihan, who's president of the Blanton Foundation in Grand Rapids, and Mary Kosak, program officer with the oversight of Invest Early, which is the program which is now taking place in Itasca County. So I'd like these two to talk just for a few minutes about what's happening in Itasca County. We'll start with Mr. Houlihan.
Welcome. If you could give your name for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Jim Houlihan, and I'm president of the Blanton Foundation, located in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. Mr. Chair and members, the foundation is here to testify about our early childhood initiative called Invest Early. As Senator Saxog said, my colleague, Mary Kosak, will provide the testimony about our program this morning. Mary visioned the project and, in her capacity as program officer, oversees it. I simply want to take a minute and brief you on why the Blanton Foundation is involved. Our mission at the Blanton Foundation is to strengthen communities in rural Minnesota, especially in our home community of the Grand Rapids area. And we have a vision, and our vision is that healthy communities are grounded in strong economies. So why is the Blanton Foundation involved in early childhood? We are involved because it helps us accomplish our mission of creating healthy rural communities, and it helps us accomplish our vision of creating strong economies. It's about kids, it's about families, it's about healthy communities, and it's about strong, healthy rural economies. Our Invest Early initiative will be our third largest grant ever in our 60-year history. Currently, we are investing $1.5 million a year, and we are expected to do that for at least a 10-year period. So we take it seriously. And I just wanted to provide the why a foundation in a community of 8,000 would be involved in an early childhood initiative. And Mary, better than anyone, can provide more details, including the passion.
Thank you, Mr. Houlihan. Ms. Kosak?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time today. My name is Mary Kosak, and I work at the Blanton Foundation in Grand Rapids, and I am here today in support of the E-12 linkages bill. Why do I support it? Because there are many similarities between what is being proposed in this bill and what is happening in Itasca County with our Invest Early Collaborative. I was asked to come here today to describe Invest Early. The partners, the main partners with Invest Early, are Kutaska Head Start, all of the ECFE and school readiness programs from all four school districts in our county, Itasca County Public Health, the YMCA, and Itasca Community College. Other supporting partners include Adult Basic Education, Special Ed, Children's Mental Health, Child Care Providers, and Bemidji State University. Currently, we are serving 270 children ages 0 to 5 and their families. The core services that are provided through Invest Early include infant and toddler classrooms, preschool classrooms, parent education, and health services. We also have an additional menu of services that the families are allowed to choose from depending on their needs or interests. These include adult basic ed, transportation, wraparound child care, which is available 5 days a week, 12 months of the year, family development, and then mental health support. I'd like to also share a few other points about Invest Early. We have one common application form. I know early childhood programs can be really confusing to families. I mean, they hear all of these terms being thrown about Head Start and ECFE and school readiness and yada, 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 and they don't know which is which or what they should sign up for. Well, they just come in. They're given one application. They fill it out, they turn it in, and then the staff takes care of figuring out where to slot them in. The staff figures out where the funding is going to come from to fund their early childhood programming experiences. Because of this sharing that happens between all of those partners that I mentioned, we also have several blended classrooms. And by blended, I mean you might have some Head Start kids in there, ECFE kids, school readiness kids, the ones that are being funded through Invest Early. They're all in there together. None of them have any idea, nor do their parents, about how they're able to access these services or who's paying for them. Again, that's taken care of behind the scenes by the competent early childhood professionals. It's kind of interesting how you might walk into one classroom and see a Head Start teacher teaching side-by-side a school district teacher. I know you've probably heard of things happening in the past where there's this struggle between the two groups, but in Itasca County, we've proven that collaboration can work successfully. All of our instructors are licensed. Many of them have four-year degrees or are working towards a four-year degree. The training is shared, again, by all of the organizations that I mentioned, so they're not all off designing or preparing or planning their own training. They do it together as a group. As far as assessment, every infant and toddler is assessed using the ounce scale, and every preschooler is assessed using work sampling. Another thing that's kind of neat about Invest Early is every single kindergarten student in Itasca County is given the kindergarten readiness assessment. So because of this, we're able to definitely track the progress that is taking place. And if you're wondering what this progress is, yes, we do have results from the Invest Early initiative. In fact, we have one person who that is her position. She is considered the queen of data tracking. She collects the data quarterly from all of the sites and feeds this information to the Wilder Research Center, who is conducting a longitudinal and cost-benefits evaluation for us. We have a customized database that was developed locally. All of the information is put into this database. For example, the Invest Early staff, they track all of the attendance, parent feedback, all of that is put into the database, which is also funneled to Wilder Research, who then will provide us the detailed analysis. And this analysis should be ready for year one in about a week or two. We're expecting it any day, although I did receive word of a few different facts, and I can tell you that after a year in Invest Early, 56% of the 4- and 5-year-olds scored as proficient in all of the developmental domains combined, and that was up from 26% when they began the program. So 30% progress in 1 year of this comprehensive Invest Early programming. I really wish we could have brought the SCADs and SCADs of families that are participating in this collaborative. If they could have been here to share some of their stories with you, you would have been convinced in a heartbeat. It's just amazing what this opportunity has done for many of them. But instead, I'll just tell you that I have a favorite song, and one of the lines is, "The joy you gave me lives on and on." Well, the theme song for Invest Early could be, "The care and education you gave me lives on and on." We believe in providing the best possible start for all children, and we believe that this bill does quite a bit in providing the same opportunity for many other communities. So thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I don't know if I'm allowed to do this, but I brought several copies of the Community Dividend. It's put out by the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and Erica Moss, who works for them, came and did quite a bit of research on Invest Early, and she wrote a really nice, a very descriptive article about Invest Early. So there's plenty of copies here if you would like to take those. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It sounds quite exciting what's taking place in your community. Could you just take a minute and explain how you started bringing all those agencies and different organizations together? Was it the Blandon Foundation that kind of spurred that on, or was it just a need in the community or a progressive leader?
Well, it actually did initially start with the Blandon Foundation. In 1998, they started the Children First Initiative, and I actually worked with Children First for many years. And worked with all of these different groups. We did a lot of great things over the years, but it was still like there was that big elephant sitting in the room. How do you really conquer the big issue, the root cause of what's happening to these children? And that's when we decided to really pull everybody together into this real intense task force and get at the main issue. We drew up a matrix of everything, absolutely everything that was being funded in our area, and then studied this matrix and looked at where all the gaps were, and then started coming together, meeting at least once a month in trying to address these gaps. That was when I was able to work with the Blandin Foundation in encouraging them to put out an RFP that would encourage these groups to come together, put forth a proposal in front of the Blandin Foundation that they could then take a look at. So it was a couple years in the making as far as all of the meetings, the coming together, the working with a collaboration expert, because, again, as I mentioned before, collaboration isn't easy. I mean, it just doesn't happen overnight. People had to put their self-interest out on the table. They had to be very truthful in what they wanted to get out of it. And we worked through a lot of the issues before actually coming up with the plan that was put in front of them.
Could you also just mention the role that the school district played and at what level?
The school districts, all of the early childhood coordinators from each of the four school districts were thoroughly involved in the entire process, the 2 years that led up to the design of this. They were also the ones that did a lot of the research, checked out best practices all around the country. And then another breaking involvement is one of the districts even used all of their taconite relief funds into renovating their administration building and putting the whole Invest Early, all of the Invest Early classrooms right there. So that was like $600,000 worth. But they had seen what could happen in the field and the passion of these people and where they were going and the results they were achieving, and they decided this was a way of showing their commitment.
In relationship to the school district, how is transportation dealt with for the early childhood participants?
They are using school transportation. I don't want to say too much because I'm not real knowledgeable on those details. That's where the leadership team who is involved in the nuts and bolts of everything, they would be able to answer those questions. But I do know there is some use of school transportation, and then they also contract with another place where there's a dedicated bus and driver that does a lot of the transportation.
Okay, we have Senator Roebling and then Senator Scogin. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, after you pooled all of the funds from the different organizations, what did you have to go out and seek, maybe even on a per-child basis, for additional funding? How much more did you need?
Well, what they've done is combined the Head Start funding for the kids in the blended classrooms, and then ECFE funding, school readiness funding, and the Invest Early funding. And they have figured out that it's probably costing around $9,100 per child for this extremely comprehensive set of services that they are providing. There's a whole sliding fee scale that the leadership team developed. I do have a folder of literally all of the details. But as far as when you say seeking additional funding, that's where the Blandin Foundation funding has picked up the difference in what was needed.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Roebling.
Does that answer?
Well, do you know what the difference was? Thinking of what was available through existing pools of money and then what additional money you needed from Blandin.
For those that were not receiving anything, like I say, it was about $9,100. But for those that were in, for example, Head Start, there was an additional probably $3,000 to $4,000 needed to cover the services that they weren't getting. So Head Start, in combining the services, they've been able to receive the transportation out of the deal. They've been able to receive that wraparound child care from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., and then they've been able to add an additional day to their programming.
Okay, Senator Robler.
Now, when you mentioned child care, do some of the families qualify for basic sliding fee, and do you charge a fee for the child care component? And if so, do they use basic sliding fee, or how is that handled?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, they did address that. In fact, in the folder I have another chart of exactly what is charged according to the schedule that they have set up. But as far as accessing the child care fees from the state, there was a glitch in there. In fact, just a few weeks ago, we met with somebody from the State Department to talk about those glitches and what could be done. It had something to do with the schedule that they had already put into place, that it didn't match up. Again, I don't know the nuts and bolts of that particular question, but the director of Investorly could answer that. I could put you in touch with her.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kozak, after the application is made, staff was plugging these families into appropriate programs. Did they try to keep it balanced among the programs, or do you find some programs have a lot more people in them, or if after they got into a program they didn't feel it was the one they were looking for, is there a mechanism to move to a different program or make some changes?
Mr. Chair, members, that's an excellent question. They take a combination of people in this group that takes the applications home, so Head Start's represented, the school districts are represented. They have already an entire system in place as to how they go through these applications. They take a look at income. That's obviously the greatest risk factor. Then they have a whole other sheet of risk factors, mother's education level, any drug use, several things, just an entire page. And they go through and rank the application based on those risk factors, and they take the kids with the most needs first and plug them in. Now, if they're at 100% poverty or lower, they automatically get plugged into the Head Start slots. And then once those slots are filled, then they continue to fill in the other ones. So as far as when you say which program do they put them in, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is that it's like one program. They don't get different types of teaching or different classrooms depending on which funding source they're accessing. They're all together. So we've got the Head Start teachers, early childhood family ed teachers, school readiness teachers, all doing and teaching the same curriculum, and it's just a matter of plugging them into the age-appropriate classroom that they belong in.
Mr. Chair, but you said there were also programs for the parents.
Yes.
Do they get to move around and kind of experience all the different or am I confused?
Mr. Chair and members, the education that takes place with the parents is there's a like a classroom at each of the sites, and wherever their child is, that's where they attend. So I guess I didn't say that. There's four sites operating in the four school districts. So Greenway, Nashwauk, Keewatin, Grand Rapids, and Deer River. And there's actually 17 classrooms total located in each of these four different school districts. And some are in a community center, some are in the school, some are...
And the parents shadow their student.
Right. And it's up to the parents. Some of the parents are attending school. Some of them are attending work. And then some of them are right there at the site getting parent ed classes.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the gentleman from Blandon. Is it Mr. Houlihan?
Yes.
Is Blandon Foundation's role in this to initiate and test a model and then step back from it, or what do you see your relationship ongoing to a project of this nature, given its apparent success?
Mr. Houlihan?
Mr. Chair and members, we would hope that our role would be what we have hopefully already contributed, and that would be to convene, to facilitate, to help in the visioning process to get people and organizations to this point. We have said as an organization that we expect to fund at $1.5 million a year for up to 10 years. So we look to be involved in the future in this way, to be involved in sharing the results. Our mission says that we are about all of rural Minnesota and especially about our home community. So in a perfect world, we've helped set a model, we've helped fund, we've helped bring players together to create better early childhood in Itasca County, and we would also like to share that model and share that message statewide.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I haven't had a chance to read the bill in detail, but I noted in the publication that was handed out, it contrasts this model with that is being promoted by Rob Grunewald and Art Rolnick as being more of a scholarship model, where this is more of a collaborative model. But they felt the comment is that it's probably a very effective one with smaller communities and in rural Minnesota. And I haven't had a chance to determine from your bill is the aim of this, is your aim, if this bill were to become law, to continue to use your skills in helping bring those communities together to, in fact, reach the point of making application for grants to do this, or would this replace some of that activity? And is it tailored in such a way that it would selectively deal with small communities in rural Minnesota rather than be picked up in places where it would just be a matter of trying to get the money and a lot of resources are already available?
Mr. Houlihan.
Mr. Chair and members, we appreciate the question in many, many ways, and in many ways are not able to answer that today. And the point of my comment and response is to say that it is very much a work in process and a work in progress. However, we think that there will be lots of lessons learned that will be applicable to rural and to more than rural. So in many ways, we are just getting started, but without being too redundant and too repetitive, we would hope that the lessons learned, the things that are applicable statewide, will go far beyond rural, and that it would be somewhat disingenuous to say this is only a rural model, and the lessons of collaborations, the lessons that we're learning from bringing groups together only will work rural. Our intuition is that that's not the case. Our intuition is that the good things coming out of this program, again, will have a broad spectrum across all of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Senator Terrazre.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mary Kozak would like as a comment on that particular question, too.
Mr. Chair and members, I just wanted to add that we were in close communication with both Art Rolnick and Rob Grunewald. In fact, they had Art had come to speak to Grand Rapids, all of our Chamber of Commerce members, back in 2003. And when we built this model, we were trying to tell Art and Rob that they have a fantastic idea in the whole allowance scholarship, you know, idea that they're proposing, but that we saw some tension with the greater Minnesota, because in some parts or in some towns there actually is nothing for someone to use a scholarship or an allowance at. For example, in Deer River, there is no licensed center. So what would they do if they were given this allowance? So what we decided to do was to build on what already existed. We had a very strong infrastructure in place with the Head Start programs and the early childhood family ed programs. So we decided, we appreciated everything that Art and Rob contributed, but we said we're going to have to veer off just a little bit in order to meet the needs of greater Minnesota. So in response to your question, I'm hoping the allowance goes through also, but it's just that there needed to be something in place, too, to protect those families who had nothing to select from with an allowance.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wergen, and then Senator Olson.
Okay. Just to follow up.
Okay,
yeah.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chairman, is it Ms. Kozak? I appreciate your comment, and that was kind of what was sparking my question, is that given the different dynamics in some of the smaller communities, is there a way, when you have limited dollars, to see that this would, in fact, be directed to those that have those needs rather than those larger communities that tend to have a mixture? Yes, they need to coordinate and cooperate, but that this would be used to effectively bring some good services to communities and parents that wouldn't achieve it that way. Is that the intent of the bill, Senator Saxhog, to try to focus it there?
Mr. Chair.
At least at this point?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, we just wanted to bring the Blanton Foundation up here to review what they've been doing, and we haven't seen the bill yet. We have a couple people that are going to come up here and explain it. So.
Good.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
It just so happens that both of them are consistent. You know, the proposal that you're talking about that you're working with in Grand Rapids in the area is the same model that you have in your legislation. So,
correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, since that's the case, my question is actually based on some of the wording in the bill, so I can wait.
Okay. Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Kozak, I, too, was looking at the document in front of me, and it talked about that the initiative, it says, has also boosted the enrollment percentage of at-risk infants and toddlers in the county from about 5% to 25%. What is the barrier that's keeping it at only 25%? It sounds like what you're offering is so comprehensive. What keeps people who would really need these services from still using it?
Ms. Kozak?
Mr. Chair, members, several barriers. Probably the number one is transportation. Obviously, Itasca County is a very, very large county. And though we are providing some transportation, it's not limitless, so that's usually the number one thing from bringing the kids in. We did find, in fact, probably that jump from 5 to 25% was just the fact that the common application that I mentioned before, they're not signing up specifically for Head Start, so there's no stigma. Mm-hmm. A lot of people came out of the woodworks because of knowing that they were just signing up for early childhood. They weren't going to be labeled in any way or looked at as low income. So it has made a big difference.
Senator Bonner.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Kozak, how did you let them know about this? What was your marketing approach to reach all these people?
Mr. Chair, members, that's a great question. And you know what? We had to do almost nothing. It was pretty much word of mouth. In other words, the needs were there. And once they heard what was going to be provided, all of the Head Start slots filled up immediately. That, too, actually is rare in our area because, again, of transportation. People want to take advantage of the services, but they can't always get to the services. But this incentive brought many of them to the table. And now I forgot what my thought was that I was really going to hammer home.
Thank you.
Just a question, and I realize that we haven't gone through the legislation yet, but in the numbers of the match, the match is 15%, of which 5% could be in-kind contributions. And my question is was that based on kind of the available resources? More the proportion of the match versus some other percentage. How was that arrived at? Do you know?
No. I thought that was your writing.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll get some more information as it gets presented.
We'll. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Any other questions that committee members have? And I forget if it was Senator Olson or someone, as we were going through the questions, kind of termed the particular legislation as being more of a collaborative approach, which is almost, I think, necessary in that first step, because we have a patchwork system of services across the state, and this is, you know, the collaboration is kind of bringing those together and seeing who can provide what and take advantage of it. So,
Mr. Chair and members, what's really interesting is when this proposal was first put forward, they intended to serve 100 children and their families. The first year, they were able to actually serve 166 children and their families. And now here we are in year two, serving 270 children and families, and that's without any additional funding. So you can see how bringing these groups together, they make much more effective and efficient use of their resources. So that was, you know, one thing that we really wanted to make sure that that point came across, is collaboration does save.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your testimony. It was very interesting.
Thank you.
We do have Zoe Nicolai.
And yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxon.
I have with me now to explain the bill will be Eric Haugy and Zoe Nicolai from Ready for K.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Kozak. Welcome, Ms. Nicolai.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Zoe Nicolai. I'm the Director of Public Policy at Ready for K. And I'll take you pretty quickly through this bill so you've got some time for questions. And as we go through, I'll try to address your question about the match center stump. So this bill, I'm going to first say it's really about three C's. It's about connecting families, it's about communication, and it's about collaboration. So keep that in mind. This bill, Subdivision 1, establishes a two-year grant program to the purpose to increase children's school readiness through early childhood hubs. Those hubs would coordinate services and improve families' access to early care and education, to school programs, health services, and other kind of family supports services that can stabilize, support, and assist particularly low-income families in meeting their children's health and development. Eligible grantees would be a school district or a consortium of school districts or a tribal school that are willing to collaborate with a number of community-based early care and education providers. And that Subdivision 2 just describes the plan and what must be in it. I want to point out line 127, number C, applicants can also decide to apply for a age 3 to grade 3 or PK3 model that they can implement, and we're going to ask Bob Wadle will speak to that more specifically later. The basic components of Senate File 274, you convene an advisory committee that's outlined in Subdivision 4, and that advisory committee does an assessment of what's in the community around early childhood in terms of health and mental health services and other social services. Then they develop a plan. They may also decide to do the school readiness assessment at kindergarten entrance, so they get a benchmark for their community. How well are our 4-year-olds, our 5-year-olds when they come into kindergarten? And then they plan back and they look at what they have in their community. They develop a plan that systemically says, how can we improve access for families to what's in our community and where are the gaps? And you heard a wonderful presentation from what Grand Rapids has done to do that. On line 2.1, then another one of the basic program components is develop the kind of collaboratives that you heard about in Grand Rapids, where you're bringing together, and this is just too often has not happened in our field, where you're bringing together parents of young children, the early care and education providers, and we mean everyone. When I talked about the three C's, the communication, let's get the family, friend, and neighbor caregivers, Head Start, child care, kindergarten teachers and parents talking about what is it that our kids need to know and be able to do so that they're ready for kindergarten. Line 2.6, we think it's very important that parents have access. They need to know about what's available. And the Minnesota CCRNR network has a wonderful computer program, a new financial aid website, where you can put anything in that, where a parent could put in their information and they will find out what's the financial help available to me. Another part of the purpose of the collaborations is, as what happened in Grand Rapids, it's really to increase the spaces so that there's just more available high-quality settings. Connecting families, we know low-income families in particular benefit when that not only children are in quality early care and education settings, but families are getting connected to the health, adult basic education, it may be ELL, and other such services that support them as a family. And 2.13, shared professional development. The St. Paul Public Schools, their Project Early K, they're doing a wonderful job of sharing the professional development that happens between Head Start Child Care and the schools and the expertise that's in the schools. Meaningful kindergarten transition services. You have a letter from Claudia Otis from Proctor Hermantown, and she describes the work they're doing in their community to not just one day kindergarten roundup, but starting when a child turns four, a planful transition where you bring the early care and education providers, if the parent is using that, you bring the parent in a meaningful sequence of interactions with the kindergarten teacher so that child is really prepared, and so is the parent for when they're coming to kindergarten. Evaluation is a part of this bill. Down to 2.29, the match that you had a question about, Senator Stump, is a 15%. 5% could be in-kind. We heard about the actual buildings and the transportation the schools made available. The purpose of putting this match in the bill was really not only to stretch money, but because we think that you get more of a buy-in from the community when they're asked to also put some money on the table with a grant that they're getting from the state. And that could happen. The public schools could access Title I or first grade preparedness. You could have a local foundation like Blandon help put in that match. The Subdivision 4 simply describes the makeup of the advisory committee. Subdivision 5 describes this pre-K to age 3 grant component. Some communities, this is not a one-size-fits-all. You're going to have a lot of communities at different levels of collaboration where one community might be really ready to do this age 3 to grade 3 model, which we're going to ask Bob Wedel to talk more in detail, but very simply, the age 3 to grade 3, great outcomes for particularly focused at low-income children when you provide 3- and 4-year-old preschool, all-day kindergarten, and align and bring first, second, and third grade teachers together in a model. The curriculum is aligned. You have parent involvement from the beginning through third grade, and the outcomes are really very excellent for children being reading at the end of third grade. I think that's the Subdivision 6 describes the grant application process. Subdivision 7, the commissioner is expected to provide an evaluation of how this grant program met the goals, and appropriation is described $5 million a year for the hubs for 08 and 09 and also for the age 3 to grade 3. And with that, Senator Al. And
Mr. Chair. Senator Salzman.
Yes. Ms. Nicolai, I worked on, in 1994, the Pew Charitable Trust was awarding Minnesota some grants to work with, I think, in the metro area on family service centers. Are you familiar with that? It's been a long time ago.
Very slightly familiar.
Just as I do. And I remember that they actually, the Pew Charitable Trust came in and then kind of pulled out but left some money for Minnesota. And Governor Carlson was working with Mayor Coleman on this initiative. But I just go back to that because I remember at the time that the whole idea was that we developed these family centers where we bring education and health care together so that families had a one-stop shop.
Right.
So I see in this bill on the amendment on lines 1.11, health services, on line 1.31, health and mental health services. So I like that because even though we're talking about education, children's health care is important. But when we look at the advisory committee, I don't see anyone that represents those areas. And I just want to just note that,
yes,
that it may be something to think about, even though we're not, you know, the health committee here, I think it might be something to think about because, again, I think children's health is very important in terms of their preparation for early childhood.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saltzman, thank you for pointing out that that's a very important, it's an oversight, and I think we definitely should add it in as one of the key, a member on the advisory committee.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Senator Olson?
A follow-up on Senator Saltzman's question, but also a couple of other more detailed ones. What became of some of the efforts, the collaboratives from that earlier endeavor that are, look much like what you're proposing? Or is there a contrast between the family centers that were promoted, and I think some created and some still functioning? How different are they from what is being proposed in this bill?
Ms. Nicolai?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I can just speak from a little knowledge about that. I think the concept of a family service center where things are co-located is very similar to what's in this bill. I don't think that the family service collaboratives had a specific focus on school readiness, however, which this bill does.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chair, Ms. Nicolai, I was looking at the definition for community-based child care programs, including licensed center. Does this include or exclude church-sponsored preschool programs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, there's no intent to exclude faith-based preschools.
Thank you.
Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Nicolai, I love this kind of stuff. I think it's really important. My focus, however, has been a little stronger on parents as the teachers of their children and being the first teachers and probably the ones with the most impact in most cases, you know, for better or for worse. And I was looking in here for where you might speak about that. On page 4, number 7 is promotes ongoing parent involvement. And that's fine. I want it to be more than involvement. I want it to be helping parents be better teachers because they're teaching their children one way or the other. So I would just like to see, and my question, I guess, is that your intent to focus on that or just to have parents help plan for their child care or their early education? I mean, do you see a real teaching parents to be better teachers, helping them to be better teachers, not teaching?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, absolutely we believe that parents are a child's first teacher. And there's, I think, the section in the bill that talks about line 2.16, the kindergarten transition activities. And I wish that Claudia Otis could have been here to speak to what they're doing in Proctor Hermantown, because that is very much a part of bringing the parents into the role of this is what's going to be expected, you know, when your child comes to kindergarten. And in many cases, the child is with the parent. There is if there's a way that we can make this, what you're talking about, stand out more in the bill, I think we should work on that, because it is certainly the intent that first and foremost we understand that parents, children are with their parents' birth on, and those are the parents are the most important individuals in a child's life. So partly that's part of the bill. In terms of this connection to other services, we want families to be as healthy as they can be so that they can really take on that role of parenting.
You know, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Schein.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, just I don't want to be patronizing to people, but I think that so many of the kids who are at risk have parents who didn't have good school experiences. And so I'm really concerned about helping them be, you know, stronger parents, because I know that they have the hopes and dreams for their children, just may not know how to help them get started.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to echo what Senator Scheid was just saying about having a strong parent component. Parents are number one. Ms. Nicolai mentioned when Senator Olson asked that it was not an intention to leave out faith-based or private schools, but I'd like to ask Senator Saxhog the question, is it your intention to include private schools and faith-based initiatives in this? Is that something you're willing to add into this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, I think we'd be willing to talk about anything. There's nothing necessarily excluded.
Okay, Senator Hand, and then Senator Roebling, and then Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions, I guess, Ms. Nicolai. First, on the bill itself, is there any effort to have this whole initiative be targeted? Or can any child, any family participate regardless of income? I'm reading through it and I didn't notice anything, but how does this get targeted to the demographic that we assume has the greatest need?
Ms. Nicolai.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, the section on page 4, 4.6 through 4.19, the application review and grant awards, describes that school grants can be awarded if 60% of the grant funds to applicants having 50% or more of enrolled children eligible for free and reduced lunch. So we are attempting to target in a given those communities that have the most number of free and reduced lunch. But once a community receives a grant, it would be open to families, but the district itself would have a high number of families that would be low income.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you. And so, Ms. Nicolai, that was my question. It seems as if what we're saying is that there would be maybe a priority or a preference to grant monies to these programs that had maybe a majority of participants that would be in this at-risk category, but this is not intended to be focused exclusively on at-risk students, and I guess I would have some concern about that. But secondly, and maybe this is related, in the evaluation section, that the commissioner's got to provide an evaluation of the grant program. Is this an evaluation that would speak to the results of this program? In other words, what are the criteria that are going to be used to determine that this has been effective and helpful? And are those criteria going to be set in advance of the program getting started? Or how will we know in 2 or 3 years when it is evaluated that this has been a success?
Ms. Nicolai.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, the bill directs the commissioner to provide for an evaluation. So at this point, I can't answer that question.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just looking at the fiscal note, and I think if I'm reading this right, that the department is suggesting that they'll need 3 full-time education specialists, 2 with salary and benefits at $105,000 each, and a clerical person. And I'm just kind of wondering how that's arrived at. We're talking about, 5 to 10 grants a year, and when you give grants is a little different than actually developing and running the programs yourself. So how do we get up to $402,000 in additional funding.
Senator Roebling, in the amendment, that was taken out. So I'm sorry. What was taken out was the three provisions under Section 2. So you're right, if you were looking at the top of the – this would be on the fiscal note on page 5 for members. If you look under the section – actually, the first one is a 1 FTE. And I believe that's what you were looking at, Senator Roebling. Okay. Yep. The ones underneath Section 2 have been eliminated in the amendment. Senator Roebling? Am I confusing?
Okay. Yes. I am confused.
Right. What there was the difference between the original bill and the amendment that Senator Saxhog has presented, because the fiscal note was not updated to the amendment. So maybe I can have Mr. Nauman just go through that so he can explain the difference and match up the fiscal note with the existing amendment. Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman and members, I am looking at page 5 of the fiscal note where there's that chart that the Senator Stumpf was recognizing. Under Section 2, there are four lines that are affected. The first being, or I should say under Section 2, there are three lines that are affected. The 1.0 FTE education specialist, that cost is removed. The 1.0 FTE clerical salary benefits, agency and direct costs, cost is removed. Kindergarten assessment database cost is removed. And the reporting cost is removed under Section 3. However, there is also a new section that we can anticipate would generate a cost. And that cost is the evaluation under Subdivision 7. In visiting with the department, they anticipate that there would be about a 10% cost, 10% of the grants. So that would be $5 million grants. 10% of that would be about $500,000. So that would be an additional cost. So we could anticipate, and I should stipulate that I think we should probably request a revised fiscal note on this to ensure that we've got the numbers tight. But I'm estimating a magnitude of the total bill costing now about 10.7 in 08, 10.698 in 09, 10.698 in fiscal 10, and it drops to 10.198 in fiscal 11 because the evaluation ends in the middle of fiscal 10, so that evaluation cost would not have to be carried in fiscal 11. But I think we should request a revised note on that.
Well, I would ask you to do that, to request a new fiscal note so that we have a more accurate estimate of the exact cost. Senator Roebling, does that help?
It helps, Mr. Chair. It does seem like a lot to me. I don't know how much oversight they plan to give to the grants or how much they'll work with the local communities in developing their proposals. But if it's mainly accepting grant applications and then doing a follow-up, it seems like a lot of money.
Okay. Senator Rummel, if you have still remember your question.
It's been asked and
okay.
Answered.
Senator Bonhoff and then Senator Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Nicolai, how many communities do you expect to be served with if you assume this amount of money towards the grants and towards the hub?
Ms. Nicolai?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, that's a little bit of a difficult question. You've got anywhere from Grand Rapids was mentioned, $1.5 million a year that supported that collaboration. I know that the Minnesota Initiative Foundations, that I'm sure you're familiar with, have an early childhood initiative where they now have over 60 early childhood coalitions throughout greater Minnesota. And each one of those coalitions, they may come in with someone requesting $200,000 to do transition activities. Someone else may request they want to do the age 3 to grade 3 is in a different category. So I think we would see a range of grants, and I would see anywhere from 8 to 15 or 20. in order for them to really adequately meet the provisions of the bill.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Nicolai. I want to return to the questions that I was asking before a little bit, and just to try to clarify, my understanding is that Mr. Rolnick and the studies that he's done and the things that he's written about and the return on investment for early childhood is presumed to be based on the research that was a result of the Perry Preschool Project,
yes,
which I'm not intimately familiar with, but I have read about it and read some of the results of that study. And it seems to me that was a very intensive, very costly, high-quality program, but it was also very targeted at a particular demographic. And they had some results that were measurable, although, as it was pointed out in the article, that those things have yet to be proven to be scalable. In other words, it's hard to translate the results of Perry Preschool into some more general program. And in some ways, I see this as an attempt to do that. But that raises the question, why wouldn't we want to structure this in a way that is more similar to that study, number one, in saying let's target this at an at-risk group instead of letting anyone who wishes to self-select into it to participate. And secondly, that the evaluation component wouldn't be very specific to say we expect to see this kind of result in closing that gap or however we measure that, but there should be some specified results so that after 2 or 3 years, if we find that we're not making any progress, there would be a presumption to say let's stop doing this and do something else. That's the concern I have, is that we do things because we all want to do the right thing, but if we don't have clearly defined expectations, sometimes very difficult to stop doing it. And if this does not prove to be a good emulation of the Perry Preschool results, maybe we shouldn't keep doing it on in the future. So could you respond to that and why we wouldn't want to structure mm-hmm. this more along that line?
Ms. Nicola?
Excuse me. Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, three pieces that I'll respond to. The letter you got from Claudia Otis, in that community, they did the school readiness assessment in their school district at kindergarten entrance, and they found very similar results to what the statewide findings were, that almost 50% of kids were not fully prepared. And what was surprising to them is that this was done in a school district that does not have was not a preponderance of low-income children. And I think that there are many children who are beyond low-income or other families who benefit from that kind of information that helps them prepare their children for school. So I don't think that it is just a low-income problem in terms of getting kids ready for school. The school readiness assessment showed that 10% of the kids were not yet at all ready, and that was based, I think, and the department can correct me if I'm wrong, I think on free and reduced lunch, which goes up to 185% of poverty level. But then you've got this mix. You've got another 40% of kids. Now, maybe half of them will be fine at the end of kindergarten, but we can tell by the end of third grade we've got about, 38 or 30-some percent of kids not reading. So there is an additional 20% of children who are above that 185% of poverty and where we think that this program could benefit them. I do think the age 3 to grade 3 model that is in here, the Chicago parent-family model in Chicago was targeted to very at-risk children, and we could target that. That would, if the senator was willing to look at that, we could make it clear for the age 3, the grade 3, that be targeted to more at-risk children. And then thirdly, in terms of the evaluation, I also think Senator Saxhog, that maybe Saxhog, we would want to, we could put some clearer language in that we would want to see a demonstrated increase in children's school readiness.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that, you mentioned that currently we see about whatever the number is, 30% in third grade that are not reading. Would it be fair to say, well, if we reduce that by half over the course of the next whatever the specified period of time is, if that could be attributed to this program? I mean, something of that nature, that's what I'm getting at, is that mm-hmm. when we design these targeted or these programs to solve problems, we very rarely, it seems to me, go back and actually see if they've solved the problem. And I think that before you start, you should have a pretty clear idea of what it is you think you're going to do, and then measure what you've done versus the accomplishment of that goal. Would that be something that would be a useful target, say, cut that reading gap in half by end of third grade?
Ms. Nicolai?
Senator Stump, Mr. Chair, and Senator Hahn, Ready for K does have a very clear goal that we'd like to see 80% of kids ready for school by 2012. But that agenda is a broader agenda than just this bill. So I think it's important to set benchmarks that you're striving for, as long as you're putting resources that's going to enable the program to be successful. Then we can measure, did the program meet that X percent, whatever it may be.
Let me see if I can clarify some of the questioning that is going on, and I think Senator Hand touched on it a little bit. If you look on the first page of the amendment, it seems like the costs that we have on the last two pages of the amendment, which is the appropriation section, are directly hinged to the program components. So if someone asked, okay, what are we as a state buying for $10 million or whatever that cost might be, you could. It seems to me that you could go through here and then put a cost on each of those components. And I think that would be helpful to us, too, to see what is the cost of the assessment of local resources. Or what is the cost to develop a plan for a healthy development and so on. I think where we run into some problems, when you look on page 2, we have some very confusing language or fuzzy language in terms of looking at down on line 2.16, where it says provide meaningful kindergarten transition services. Well, we don't really know what meaningful kindergarten transitional services are, and that's what we'd like to know. And I think that's what Senator Hand is getting at, too, is that what are we really buying for the money that the state or the taxpayers are putting into it? And when we listen to the Mr. Houlihan and Ms. Kozak, it seemed like they had a community of services that were being provided, and even though they didn't put a price tag on each of those efforts over the years, I think that's what seems to be missing here, is that it would be nice to know what these costs are. The other thing is that as I was listening, it seems like we have a multitude of providers that are involved, you know, all the way from Head Start to, you know, public health to you name it. There's a whole list of providers. This will be working. This is meant, I think, to work with those providers. I think the question that a lot of us are having is, should we expect a certain amount of collaboration out of our providers already? And we've made some attempts over the years. We have some collaboratives out there, and some are functioning quite well. Some are, you know, maybe so-so. But what effort are those public services that are out there now, what effort are they going to be putting into this? And is this just another layer on top of those services? I think we want to think these things through, because we want buy-in from those services. And to some extent, we expect, or we should expect, that they work together. It doesn't always happen, but I think what we want and what you want in your legislation is to have these different services work together. I guess from a taxpayer and the chair of the committee, I would rather put our taxpayers' money into purchasing services rather than into designing, you know, another layer on top of something. So, Senator Olson, I know you had a question.
Well, no, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate very much what you've just been saying. And it's, as I've, my mind has been whirling here as I've heard that we have 60 collaborative initiatives through Minnesota Initiative working in this. There's stuff going on out there. And yet I also sense that there's a frustration that it isn't always producing that readiness that we're talking about. And the first thing that came to mind is to what the effort of this should be is if there are areas that are not being served, this that have need and maybe fairly high levels of risk, that's where this ought to be going. But the thing that I think is missing that some of us around this table, I think, have been becoming more and more aware of, is a component that doesn't need a whole new structure to achieve, and that is to use some scientific research-based literacy staff development for the people who are now functioning. There are some wonderful things going on, and there are possibilities of not necessarily being a one-on-one. They can be scaled up. That this kind of preparation can be delivered, and I would love to see some resources going to developing the skills for detecting the challenges that young children mm-hmm. are having with their visual, their auditory, in terms of what the grasping of that learning to read mm-hmm. really mm-hmm. means, mm-hmm. and the kinds of strategies, interventions, whatever you want to call them, that will start down that process and, frankly, go not only be ready for K, but we heard some evidence last night where this has actually been able to keep children from being labeled as learning disabled because they avoid that by teaching those skills early. So somewhere, for those that are out there existing, as well as the new, I don't have a problem with a new model if it's reaching into areas where we haven't gotten these things going. I agree wholeheartedly. If it's just going to be another overlay of attempting to do by structure and services without some of the real components that I think will deliver, then I think we're just going to be frustrated once again.
Ms. Nicolai?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, thank you for those comments. I think they're very important in terms of directions and some priorities in the bill. I think that what this bill does is not an additional layer or bureaucracy. It's really the glue that you heard about in Grand Rapids. You already have many things happening, but there's often a need for some additional funding that provides the glue that helps fill the gaps, et cetera. I did want to respond to Senator Olson's comments about literacy, and I would like to ask if we could hear Bob Wadle is here to talk specifically about age 3 to grade 3, and in particular literacy. So can we invite him up here,
yes,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please. There's always a place at the table there for a former Commissioner of Education. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, it's always good to be back with you, especially discussing issues that you're laboring over this morning. For the record, my name is Bob Wadle. I'm a former commissioner of the Department of Children, Families, and Learning, and right now I work with an organization called Education Evolving. Clearly, the objective here is really about closing the achievement gap. We know that some kids come to the kindergarten schoolhouse gate with such a gap that they never recover. So the achievement gap is not something that happens at grade 3 or grade 5. It happens far earlier. And we've simply got to take advantage of these early learning years because the early learning years are not something that we can say, well, we'll get to later. That we've got to use those early learning years when they're available, because that's when those little brains, those sponges, are really mopping up all of the literacy learning and the language learning, and we simply have to take advantage of those. The part of the bill that I want to speak to is really the second part, where you talk about the creating of schools or learning models from age 3 to grade 3. This is a model that a number of us have been working on for the last 5 or 6 years. In this model, we do very specifically define what literacy is. It's not something that's amorphous. You can really define very specifically what is it that you mean when we talk about literacy. And we've been working with the researchers at the University of Minnesota, at the University of Oregon, and also within the Minneapolis public schools to really define what it is that we talk about. So everyone, when they look at it, can say, oh, I know what that means, as opposed to wondering. You know, if I ask you all, do you think children should come to school ready? We would probably get all hands raised up. And then we would say, well, what do you mean by that? Whoa. Then we get all kinds of differences. We know what literacy readiness is. We can define it. We've got the sound research to back that up. And the good news is that we can measure it. And even the better news is it doesn't cost hardly anything to measure student progress. And quite frankly, a teacher can't get along without it. And so part of the age 3 to grade 3 model that we've used is to define literacy and then put into place working with whichever organizations, including families, that are working with children to work with those organizations. And we align, of course, the work with AmeriCorps members, so that the AmeriCorps members, who, of course, are generally college graduates, are very excited about working, and so they are delivering early literacy services wherever the children might be. Now, we put an emphasis, because of the legislation, on Head Start. And so in this age 3 to grade 3 model, the kids are getting intensive literacy training in Head Start. They come out of Head Start. Now, here's where the evaluation piece kicks in. What you really want to know is, how well are the children doing when they're in the kindergarten, first, and second grade? That's what you want to know. That's why we have early childhood programs. A whole lot of other reasons, too. But so what we need to do is put into place a system of tracking student progress. How well are they doing at age 5? Not on hour-long pen and pencil-paper tests, of course not, but on those literacy measures. And then you simply continue to aggregate those data. You follow the kids into kindergarten and first and second grade. For the kids that are in Minneapolis PICA, Head Start, we are now following them. They're now in second grade in the Minneapolis schools. We've designed a control group. So this is a pretty sophisticated study. So there's a matched control groups of kids who matched on age, sex, socioeconomic status, special education, and English, multiple languages. So we've got good control groups, and we're seeing that these kids are continuing to have their to be statistically significantly ahead of the control group in terms of early literacy. Now, the importance of this model is that we really have combined pre-K and K-3. We treat them most of the time as if they were if they were isolated. The kindergarten teacher hardly ever talks to a pre-K provider. Why would that be? Under this model, they look at themselves as if they are a single unit. They work together. And so the kids are just going right through from pre-K into K-3. So under the age 3 to grade 3 model, we're not setting up new kinds of schools necessarily, but we're working with the current organizations that are working with the children. So the real goal there is really on target by the end of third grade. The goal is not on target at kindergarten. That's good. But kids will regress very quickly if they're not in a literacy-rich K-1, 2, and 3 program. So the objective is literacy by the end of third grade as measured by the MCAs, the state MCA test. And you can measure that. You can gather those data all along. So when you're talking about this evaluation, the evaluation of this kind of model is not difficult at all, and it certainly is not expensive. So you can track student progress because of the mechanisms that Minnesota has put into place with these kids and get a good handle as to how well they are doing and therefore draw some conclusions about the impact of the program. I would make a number of suggestions, Mr. Chair, with respect to this bill. One is in Subdivision 5, to me it's pretty restrictive that this revenue would only go to district schools and to or to tribal schools. I would suggest that we make this more open, that the commissioner should issue an RFP and a request for a proposal and look at the very best proposals that would be put forward to the commissioner, and not just make it restricted only to district-operated schools or to tribal schools. So I think we need to look at the best applications that would come forward to really implement this age 3 to grade 3 model. One other comment, Mr. Chair, before...
Can we get a clarification? We don't have a Subdivision 5 that says anything about tribal schools. So are you looking at the bill or the delete all amendments?
What am I looking at?
You need...
You probably are looking at the bill and not the delete all amendment.
Okay. Subdivision 5, I believe on page 3. Pre-K to grade 3, school readiness and academic success.
Mr. Chairman, is that limited to... Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wadle, or Dr. Wadle, is that... where does it say that it's limited to tribal schools?
Oh, it refers to Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. Was that your question? Subdivision 5 refers to I believe subdivision the previous part of the bill where it identifies school districts and tribal schools as the eligible applicants.
Here it is, line 1.15.
Subdivision 2.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on page 1, line 20, or in that 18 to 20, an interested applicant must submit a plan to the Education Commissioner in a formal manner to implement an early childhood community hub that is located in a public school, a tribal school, or other appropriate community location. Is there a place that requires that it be both a... Okay, it must be a school district, a consortium of school districts, or a tribal school. You don't think it should be limited to those three? You're saying it should be beyond that?
Saying this piece.
Well,
on page of the delete all amendment, page 1, 14 through 17?
Subdivision 2.
Mr. Weddle?
Subdivision 2.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I don't have specific language, but I would open it to or to other organizations that are interested or providing programs and services to young children. For example, there are any number of charter schools and other private nonprofit organizations that are. Or are very interested in working at the pre-K level. As a matter of fact, Walden University has just issued an RFP requesting proposals from interested parties around the world to submit proposals for who will come to Minnesota to start the very best age 3 to grade 3 schools, and Walden will select from the very best proposals from around the world to come to Minnesota to start school. So it shouldn't be restricted just to what we currently have, I guess is my point.
Okay. Questions? Thank you, Mr. Wadle.
Start.
We have one more person to testify, and then reflection on the clock.
Who's testifying?
And we also have a couple more bills that we want to hear yet. This is good preparation.
Mr. Chair.
Good preparation.
This whole discussion, I think it's important that that we do possibly include other organizations, but the important thing here is collaboration, too. So if we're establishing another organization that isn't going to collaborate, then we have a problem. So,
Senator Wergen?
Mr. Chair, I sent Senator Saxhog a note, and I'd like to just iterate to the group what I sent on the note, basically what I sent asking him if he would approve it. On line 1.14, it says an applicant for a grant must be a school, and then I would suggest, or organization, and then delete up to interested in. So it would say an applicant for a grant must be a school or organization interested in collaborating with community-based early childhood. And to follow that through then, on line 1.20, it would read community hub that is located in an approved community location. And Mr. Chair, if Senator Saxhog is interested, I would offer that as amendment, not to blow everything up, but to get at what we're trying to do, and that's making sure children are served in a collaborative way in any setting we can possibly serve them to get them ready for kindergarten.
You could have somebody that doesn't want to participate in the school district.
You could add the school. That's what she meant.
Senator Saxhog? Well, Mr. Chair, you know, there's kind of a thread that goes throughout the bill, and isn't. I think we probably have to change more than one piece here, as Senator Wergen is talking about. But I think we can do that, and that's obviously a piece that I think the committee is interested in seeing being discussed. So. Whether we can do that right now, we certainly need to work on that.
Okay. All right, we'll take that under advisement.
Mr. Chair, in order to do that, I'll have to withdraw the motion.
Okay. I didn't realize it was a motion.
It was, okay. Mr. Chair, but that's okay. As long as it's on the record and I understand that Senator Saxhog's impetus is simply to get children ready for collaborative without being so exclusive, I'm okay with that.
Okay. All right, Senator Hand.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in, I guess, the spirit of what Senator Wergen is talking about, I would not offer as an amendment, but ask that an amendment be considered in the evaluation section on page 4 that would be a little bit more specific about what the department and its evaluation must do. And I think Mr. Wadle's comments were very, to me, in my view, on target in that we ought to be looking at is asking the question, by the time the MCAs are taken in grade 3, have we seen progress that can be attributed to this program? And that should be the burden of the evaluation, is to demonstrate that this has made a difference in improving those literacy test scores. And I think that we ought to specify that in the legislation to make sure that when we evaluate this, we can go back and say this has been effective. And if it hasn't been, then we would have an opportunity to say, let's retarget the money and try another approach. So I would just suggest that if Senator Saxhog is willing, that we try to work on some language to specify more clearly the evaluation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxon.
Yes, Senator Hand, we'll work on that evaluation piece for sure.
All right. Okay. We have Mr. Pritchard. Is he? Okay. I would like to testify. Welcome, Mr. Pritchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council. I just wanted to speak to some of the issues in the bill, and some, frankly, a lot of them were raised, or a number were raised by committee members. I think we all obviously...
Before you start, I'm sorry, do you have the delete all amendment?
Okay. Yeah, I'm working on that. Thank you. I think we all obviously desire to help kids, but we believe that this bill, in some respects, embodies a number of elements which we believe would move us in the wrong direction. First of all, we have a concern that it takes schools further away from their mission of educating kids to raising kids, the focus on from a focus on academics to social service providers, where you create these hubs and place them in different school districts. And so we have concerns about that. We also, I think, realize that any time an organization is going to be successful, it really has to have a clear focus mission. And asking schools to do other things takes them away from their mission, which is educating kids. We also have concerns about adding another layer of bureaucracy. We also, another concern is the focus not on parents. Just looking at the language, you get the feel reading the bill that parents are kind of along for the ride. On the second page at the 2.1, it talks about developing collaborative partnerships among school-based early childhood programs, kindergarten teachers, other school officials, community-based Head Start and child care programs, including on and on. And they talk about unlicensed family, friend, and neighbor caregivers, but parents aren't even mentioned. And we feel that ultimately parents raise children, not schools or social service agencies. Also, the lack of focus. It talks about districts having to have a certain percentage are poor or below us, free lunch programs. But that doesn't mean those kids are the ones that are being targeted. That just means those districts are eligible. And I think that even raises some dangers from what some of the literature says about targeting kids who really don't need these services. Obviously, we have concerns about mental health screening, and that's always a part of a lot of these early childhood programs. And I guess finally, I would just raise issues about, is this the wisest use of limited resources? A lot of studies out there suggesting that the long-term gains aren't there with these early childhood programs, that by grade 3, the kids are no better off than if they weren't in these programs. Studies have been done on Head Start and other programs. And that's significant. I mean, if the goal is to get these kids so that they're able to perform academically, educationally, be successful, we have to see results. We aren't. The results drop off. Another concern is this the place to focus a lot of resources? Frankly, if you compare the United States to other countries, kids in the fourth grade in the United States do better than their counterparts internationally. In the area of math, they score higher than 58% of their international fourth graders. But this drops to 34% by the eighth grade and 14% by the 12th grade. In science, U.S. kids score better than 92% of the international fourth graders, but this drops to 61% by the eighth grade and 29% by the 12th grade. In reading, we score better. Fourth graders score better than 26 of 38 countries surveyed. So is this the best place to put the resources would be a question we would raise. And there's a lot of money involved here. I mean, we're talking about thousands of dollars per kid. And finally, there's the concern, will this actually, in some respects, make matters worse? There's a number of studies showing that children who are put in preschool and early childhood programs for extended periods of time exhibit antisocial behavior or misbehavior in terms of bullying, aggressiveness, and lack of motivation to learning. I guess our view is we really need to look at, if we're going to help children, ultimately we have to help parents. Because you may train and do all these programs with children, but if you put them back in a home which isn't working, I don't think you've been successful. What is the answer? We think you need to empower parents. They have to have the responsibility and be empowered through scholarships, school choice, allowing parents to put the child in an environment which they think is going to help their child to succeed, whether it's a values-based education, a discipline focus, or whatever. But we think parents need to be empowered. And I think we need to engage the community, not creating another government or expanded government bureaucracy, but what can we do to engage churches and community groups in terms of mentoring and coming alongside mothers and parents? And then finally, we believe that marriage is absolutely critical. Kids need a mom and a dad. And in a sense, I see the legislature dealing with the fallout of the breakdown of the family, but if we're really going to, I think, get at the core problem, we have to strengthen marriage, and children need a mom and a dad. So with those remarks, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. I think, is there anyone else that wants to testify on this? We will have Okay. Ms. Ephraim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm a mother of three, a pediatrician, and a policy analyst for EdWatch. We are gratified to see the delete all amendment because it is significantly improved from the bill as it was introduced. However, there are still some concerns we would raise, particularly about the move to expand the kindergarten readiness assessment. That assessment is vague and subjective in the academic areas of reading and math. We were talking about literacy earlier, and yet the criteria on that assessment have such vague items as gains meaning through listening or shows an appreciation of books and reading, which might be nice things to do, but doesn't really tell a whole lot about real literacy skills.
Dr. Ephraim,
yes.
I think that was taken out too.
The assessment?
Yeah.
Not in the delete all amendment?
No. I don't believe so.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the delete all amendment from the House bill of the same one, which I assumed was the same, but I guess that's a dangerous assumption. Is the language the same about aligning the pre-kindergarten assessment or the pre-kindergarten standards with the K through 3 assessments? Is that still in there?
Line 3.3.
I think so.
Yeah. Subdivision 5.
On page 3.
Well, then we will just raise the concern of the early childhood indicators of progress and their vagueness, their subjectivity, again, in not only math and reading, but also bringing up controversial psychosocial topics that unfortunately do nothing to improve the achievement gap, plus they undermine parental authority. And I'd be happy to talk about the particulars. The other thing that we would say is that many of the programs in there, as Mr. Pritchard mentioned, are not showing evidence base of effectiveness, especially for their high cost. And I will, instead of going through those in detail, pass out a handout with the specific quotes.
Okay.
If I brought the right pile, I will give it to you as soon as I'm done. So those are our general concerns, and I'd be happy to answer specific questions. But basically, want to caution you again with concerns about cost, effectiveness, and parental authority.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Ephraim. Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, just not necessarily a question for Dr. Ephraim, but just a comment about the kindergarten readiness assessment. Is that a standard format that is used across the state? And I don't think I've ever seen it. Is that something that we as a committee could just take a look at? And I mean, if the goal here is to improve the readiness, I'd be curious just to know what kinds of things that we're evaluating. I'm not sure. Is that a standardized format? I don't know.
I think it is. I don't know if we would have time to get into that today.
I
know Ms. Carlson is here from the department, but I you know, we still have two more bills that we'd like to talk about, but I think that that would be a good discussion, and keep that in the back of your mind so that we get back to it. Senator Wergen?
Mr. Chair, I won't belabor the point, but there's a part of me that wrestles a little bit with what we're doing. All of us want kids taken good care of when they're infants, toddlers, etc. But there's a part of me that wonders also, from a little different perspective, if we're kind of missing the boat. The family mobility is there. We struggle with children pre-kindergarten being identified for the services that they need, all of that stuff. But when the kids hit kindergarten, they're all there. In other words, before that, we struggle with how to find the kids that are at risk, how to serve the kids that are at risk, all of that stuff. But all of a sudden, they all hit kindergarten, and all of a sudden, they're all there, whether they've found the services before that or not. There's a part of me that wonders, and I'm just going to throw it out there for the heck of it. There's a part of me that wonders if we aren't doing this backwards. If we funded kindergarten students at a 2.0 per student instead of a 0.557 or what we ever have now, and had kindergarten levels at 1 to 8 for teacher versus student, if we couldn't do more effective work with all of them there than everything we wrestle to do in advance. We absolutely do want great daycare. We do want the sliding fee daycare so that good daycare is accessible for all kids. But I wonder sometimes if we aren't concentrating hard enough on kindergarten and getting those class sizes in kindergarten so low that we can actually meet the needs of kindergartners and have them ready for the rest of their school experience. That K through 3 is where you catch all kids. They don't miss K through 3, but we miss them in daycare and in these programs, and sometimes I wonder if we're putting...
Well, I my only response would be that I think this committee has heard a lot of information about the importance of the early childhood years.
Yeah, I know.
And whether it's from... our used to be our chief economist, but or whether it's from people like Mr. Wadle, I think, and or more individual programs, I think demonstrate that there is a lot of things that we can do to prepare those children for that kindergarten, first grade experience, especially if they have some needs, and a lot of children do have needs, and a lot of them are family connected. But I think that's what we'd like to get at. And I do agree with Senator Hand that not all. I mean, we do need to look at our programs. I think from an area of risk, because I don't think the state will ever have the capacity to just flat out take care of everybody. I mean, you're not going to have that, but. So we do have to ration our resources to try to get at those students that are very high risk. With that, Senator Saxog, I think we're going to move on. Senator Rummel has a proposal on early childhood.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair. Could I move that we lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus education finance bill?
Senator Saxog, yes, we would like to. We have a number of things that we'd like to address in that. A number of members here would made suggestions. So Senator Saxog moves that Senate File 274 be laid on the table, and we will we will be coming back to that with some. I hope in the relatively short period, next few weeks anyway. So. On Senator Saxog's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for your all those who offered their ideas. Senator Rummel? Members, we have a fiscal note for Senate File 318. May want to hang on to the fiscal notes and put them in your folder so that when we do come back, you'll have that information available. Senator Rummel, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
This morning we have been spending a good deal of time talking about the importance of early childhood education in terms of having children ready for school and for school success. Senate File 318 provides simply additional funding for early childhood screening. It does not change current law. It simply attempts to align the allotment we give to the screening process with the realities of what it costs to do that today. With me today is Linda Sandvig of the School Nurses of Minnesota, who can give us more background on the bill and what those realities are.
Hey, Senator, thank you, Senator Rummel. Ms. Sandvig.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Sandvig. I'm here on behalf of the School Nurses of Minnesota, but also to let you know that we've worked in a little coalition on this bill with the Minnesota Community Ed Association, with the School Boards Association, and Ready for K. It happened that all of our organizations had on their legislative platforms a simple bill that would look at, we have a mandate in place on early childhood screening, and it's not adequately funded. So one of the dilemmas you will be looking at is the new programs you're looking at and those programs that are on the book and what they are being funded. What this bill simply does is it increases the funding. It was put 2 years ago, a graduated funding. It used to be a straight funding for all different age levels when it was 3.5 to 5 at $40. That had not been changed since 1999. What happened in 2005 is we changed the screening requirements to three-year-old and put in graduated so that three-year-olds would be paid at $50, four-year-olds at $40, and then it was actually reduced for kindergarten to $30. This bill would simply, it would not completely close the gap, but would provide some additional funding on a program because school districts do have to go into their general fund generally to pay for the funding. The average in 2006 was $65 per child. And what we found with the new requirement with going lower is that some of those districts with three-year-olds, it takes more time to screen those individuals, and we're looking at more outreach. We're still looking at the majority of kids being screened at the four-year-old level, but some districts actually lost money in that the funding for five-year-olds was reduced to $30. So this bill just would simply increase $10 in each of those categories for funding. I guess what we'd just like to say, as Senator Rumble said, we are not looking at changing the law, but we think that there have been good results from this program that tie into what you're looking at, school readiness. And the law has been in effect since 1977. So some of the concerns with looking at early detection and health care issues that would address, and I would say that one of the important things about this program is provided access to children to community and school-based services. And so, for example, in almost 60,000 children that were screened in 2005, there were referrals. We were talking about parent education, 6,000 to ECFE, 4,000 to school readiness, 1,300 Head Start, 400 to literacy programs, ABE programs for parents, so it really gets them connected with that. And on the other hand, for healthcare issues, it also identified over 4,000 kids with speech and language issues, hearing, 4,000 vision, all across the road. So I think it's important to look at that this is kind of an early thing. It's driven by parents. School districts have to provide it. It's a mandatory, but it's driven by parents and exchange with information with them.
Can you just enlighten me on the numbers that you went through? Were those numbers that were screened, or were those
Mr. Chair, those were numbers that's based on department data in the governor's budget that looked at numbers of children that were screened and the referrals.
And what you're saying is that the average, the cost for screening across all age groups was about $65?
Yes.
And so maybe this predates my time here, or chair. Did we put in place the $30 and $40 and $50 as a reduction, or was that just put in as a to kind of step up to the different levels?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 2005, screening used to be from 3.5 to 5, focusing on that. They reduced the age to 3. The idea was that having a graduated would encourage people to seek at the earliest age. So it was put as an incentive in doing that. I can tell you at the time, we did testify that about the same problems we're talking about now, that it was an unfunded mandate and had concerns that in doing the outreach for the younger kids that it would cost more money and would do more time. And so that's why the four different organizations have a bill before you this year.
So the cost of screening doesn't vary according to the age. The cost of screening really is pretty much a flat expense.
Mr. Chair, the numbers that we were given by the department is the average across. So I think you'll find in some district, I think you'll find that lots of times that because it's more time intensive for 3-year-olds and outreach, that there might be more costs in those. But the numbers that we have are just an average. We don't have enough data to look at each individual age. What I hear from my school nurses is that it probably takes like an additional 20 minutes to do like a 3-year-old versus a 4-year-old in dealing with it. I think they believe as far as the earlier age, but it's just it takes more resources. The other thing I just like to point out with the cost, too, is that we have more and more kids that are not English speaking and parents when they come in. So 61% of the school districts actually had to hire interpreters, which for some of these small districts cost $125 an hour. So that's an additional expense with looking at the diversity of the population, too.
Okay, we have a couple questions, but is the need to try to encourage those 3-year-olds, is that a need? What seems to be happening is that, I mean, from the school district's perspective, do they not want to pay for it? Or I see some head shaking back there, but okay. I guess I'm wondering where, why would you not come in with a bill just saying, you know, $65, if that's the flat rate across all ages, versus the 40 and the 60 or something?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we were not trying to change the structure of how the legislature had put together the bill in 2005, which was trying to put more emphasis. Okay. Truly, we were just looking at putting more money into the program.
Okay. All right. Gotcha. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, when you mentioned that you have a lot more non-English-speaking families, how has your participation rate held up? Do you find that you are able to reach out to those families of 3-year-olds, or are you not getting them until 2 weeks before kindergarten, or is it costing you a lot more for outreach? What's happening so that you get them into the screening?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, I think what we're finding, and we don't have a lot of experience with it because that's just been in place for a shorter period of time, and there were 18,000 3-year-olds that were screened. And anecdotal information that we hear is, yes, outreach is, because some parents believe that this is a test, and so they think if they delay their kid right before kindergarten, that so we have to do some things within the outreach to explain what the screening is in dealing with young kids. So I think what we're seeing is that, yes, it will probably, until it becomes more of the norm, take some additional resources as far as doing the outreach. And we're just seeing changing demographics as far as looking at interpreters.
Senator Hand, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to clarify. I don't recall, and maybe I hope you can answer my question, but is the screening a mandatory event that every pre-kindergarten student must go through some kind of a screening activity? Is that the case? And if so, does it have to be done through the school, or can it be done in other
Chair, Senator Hahn, the screening is mandatory for school districts. School districts have to provide it. But parents, you also have to notify parents that they can get it through their own health provider, a community clinic, an alternative, and so that they can provide that information. Parents also can refuse to participate in some of the components with that. But it is mandatory on that. What we like to say, it's mandatory for us, but it's the parents in the driver's seat, because the information that we provide is completely up to them whether they're going to follow through.
Thank you. Okay. Do you have anyone else, Senator Rummel, that would like to testify?
We have with us Denise Herman from the School Nurses of Minnesota and Jackie Johnston from Community Education of Chaska.
Okay, and we'll take some testimony. And
basically, I think what they can do is tell you a little bit about what happens when they're out there in the field.
All right.
Sure.
Welcome. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Denise Herman, and I am a school nurse for the last 20 years, and I'm with the School Nurse Organization of Minnesota. And I get to see these little ones coming in every day doing early childhood screening. And I just want to comment on the English as the second language issue. We do a lot of outreach into those communities, and not only in my district but throughout. And you talked about the community collaboratives and things like that. We really reach out to where those community collaboratives are. We do lots. Sometimes screenings are done in churches. So we really work to find that community. And the communities where English is the second language are a community where it is verbal. So they have a great experience, and there is a great word of mouth. Take your child in. You want to get this done. So we work really hard to reach out to all those communities and use all the community avenues. Can we do a better job? Absolutely. But we really do work hard to get to those. So this is a very worthwhile program. We see children every day, and it is a great opportunity for families to come in and get connected to community resources that they might not otherwise get. Do they want a Head Start? Do they want an early K? Where would they like to go? What do they want? It is parent-driven. The parent participates in the whole entire process and can choose or elect many of the components or none of the components. So the parent is in the driver's seat here. We provide the information to them. It is a screening program. It is not diagnostic. So it is a really great service for kids.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, could you please just take a couple of minutes to describe what that screening process, what you actually are screening for?
Sure.
Rather than the generalities don't kind of register.
Sure. Excuse me.
Ms. Herman.
Senator, Mr. Chair and persons, someday I'm going to get this right, exactly how to address you all. There are several components. A family is welcomed, you know, obviously when they first come in to participate. The components include a vision, so screening to see if they can see distances, a hearing screening, which on a three-year-old, you have to do a little bit of play with them because they don't always get the connect, oh, I hear the beep, raise my hand, so they play with their blocks. It's a developmental component, and we all, the Department of Health has the tools, so different places choose tools that have been pre-approved with the Department of Health, Department of Education. So developmental screening in my setting is, you know, stacking blocks and counting and drawing and making verbal associations, listening to their speech. Looking for speech articulation errors. Again, this is all screening. So we try, and then all these tests are norms, so we kind of look at, you know, yeah, you're the average kid, or maybe are you having difficulty, those kinds of things. So vision, hearing, we do height and weight. We do a health history review with the family, and do they have any concerns regarding health? Do they have a health care provider? Do they have access to Minnesota care? Do they need community resources for dental care? Do they have a library card? So everything, they go through the different components, and then they have an exit interview, and the parent, you know, where if the parent has concerns, we'll ask, do you have a concern? Are you concerned about this or that? And if they do, and then if perhaps in doing and being with this child for the last 45 minutes, if we can also see that concern, then we can point them to the resources that they'd like to have. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. And if you would give your name for the record, please.
Jackie Johnston.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Jackie Johnston. I'm the Director of Community Education for District 112, and I'm also the MCEA Legislative Chair. And I've been asked to speak from the perspective of the funding as far as it affects the school-based programs. And actually, in most districts, the overage cost for running this program is absorbed through the Community Education General Fund. And as you know, Community Ed has not received any funding increases. In fact, we've received funding decreases over the past few years. So this has impacted our ability to provide other kinds of services to our communities because we have to cover this deficit with our fund balances. And as they've been saying over and again, many times to get to these kids, we do have to go into the communities and do things that are of an extraordinary cost. And so I'm just speaking on behalf of the impact, the fiscal impact on our program areas.
Thank you. Any questions that members have? Well, thank you very much. And Senator Rummel, do you want to move that? Well, I think one caveat for committee members would be how we might adjust that the dollar amount for those screenings. At least from the information that I've that's been presented, it seems like the and I'm not sure who presented it, but maybe you could get us some information as to the average cost. If you could give us. Oh, okay. I guess it's in the budget book from the Department of Education.
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
All right. We'll check on that and then make the appropriate have our fiscal people make the appropriate recommendations to us for in regard to your legislation.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 318 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Omnibus Bill.
Okay. Any other questions on Senator Rummel's motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Okay, thank you. And Senator Clark, we have Senate File 291. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm only sorry I had to miss a bunch of the very good conversation that I know that you're having on the earlier bills. I apologize for that. This bill is the companion bill to House File Number 5, and it essentially, I think, can be thought of as a restoration bill. It does three different things, and I'll just say briefly what they are, and then I'll kind of go back through them. One is it is restoring ECFE funding back to before the cuts on allotment and cuts started happening, and it provides both school readiness and Head Start, essentially $1 million more per year. And while it may have been brought up earlier, I always think it's important to start off with our context, which is right now about 50% of our kids are not yet ready when they're hitting kindergarten. We heard testimony earlier from the Department of Education that means that they're not necessarily at the four-year-old skills, let alone at the skills that we might think a kindergartner would have entering kindergarten. And that as we're looking at where we're investing our money and where we're going, that one of the things that many of us have talked about is closing the achievement gap. And we're fortunate in Minnesota to have a number of strategies that parents have been able to tap into over time. And some of them have to do with what we're now calling more of a pre-K or a school readiness kind of experience, and some have to do with parent education. So the first piece of this, again, it relates to the early childhood family education program. Senator Bonhoff has a bill that is a bit more ambitious and goes a bit more broadly than this does. But if you look back at what happened with the cuts, in 2002, 2003, and 2004, the funding was at $120. And then when an allotment happened and the cuts happened, my voice seems to be going. It was at $96 in 2005, $104 in 2006, and it's currently at $112. If it was going to have kept up with inflation, though, we would be at $171. And there has been increased expectations and believe some things that we've grown to understand over time. But this really has been our premier parent education and family learning type of program. I think that you may recall that that our
our parents have been participating. They find that they have better connections with their children. They've been seeing a variety of outcomes. They are not the same kinds of outcomes, however, that we expect with the other two kinds of resources. The other two resources are geared towards making sure that our kids are ready for kindergarten or taking them where they're at and helping them improve. In the case of Head Start, they deal with kids that they work with children whose families are below 100% of poverty, not 150% of poverty, not 200% of poverty, but these are very lowest income children. There was information out in the past week that showed that Minnesota's gap in poverty in terms of the very lowest income families has grown like 62%. We might happen to be number two in the country on the number of kids and families that are in that lowest income, but we are growing exponentially on what's happened, and that's been over the last 5 years. One could argue that that is connected with our going backwards on our commitment to the families that are at risk, perhaps both in this committee and in other committees. So if we're serious about closing that gap and looking at what the impact is on those families, both of these programs should be looked at. Head Start right now is serving about 16,800 children. Just over 2,900 of them are with the state funds. 14.2% of the kids are diagnosed with a disability, and about 25% of them are English language learners. That's statewide. That's not just a metropolitan. That's a statewide number. School readiness has been dealing with some similar kinds of children with a variety of different challenges. And what we've seen in both situations where the money has actually connected with the families is that the child has been able to make progress. Right now, we're obviously only screening once the kids get into kindergarten, but in Head Start, they actually are now doing assessments 3 times a year, so they're seeing real progress about how children are doing with pre-literacy and some of those other kinds of expectations that we have. So this bill, while very modest, and I would argue we have other proposals that would help many more children, maybe particularly one I like, get the kinds of families, get the resources so that our children actually can close the achievement gaps. An important part of this reason why this bill is here is if we're talking about basics, if we're talking about funding stability, if we're talking about the kinds of tools that are available locally, it's important that we acknowledge that we have a lot to build on and that these services have been underfunded. And I think that's the main point of this bill, is we are underfunding it. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Clark, thank you for presenting the bill. A couple of questions. One, on the second page of the bill, you've got inserted in the paragraphs 1 and 2 the word entitlement. I'm just curious as to what the meaning of what the intent of inserting the word entitlement. And then maybe for Mr. Nauman, but paragraph C, I'm trying to connect that $10 million to the fiscal note. I'm having a little trouble trying to connect that. But maybe while you're looking at that, Senator Clark, is there any connection that can be made between ECFE and Head Start into improving the achievement gap reduction? And the reason I ask that is just as I was looking through some of the material that was provided from one of the testifiers at the last bill we talked about, Senator Saxog's bill, very critical of Head Start in the sense of from the Department of Human Services, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, basically saying that that the long-term effects of Head Start is very limited or doubtful or may not exist at all. I know that ECFE is a very popular program in my district, the school districts, many people participate. It is not a targeted program necessarily. A lot of people of all, socioeconomic dimensions participate. But I'm not aware that there is a connection between that and an improvement in results. And I guess if the question is, do we want to devote resources to trying to move the improvement of results, how do you make the case to do that?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark.
Senator Hahn. A couple different things. First off, ECFE is not directly, in my opinion and from what I've seen, related to closing the achievement gap. In terms of the research-based preschool, pre-kindergarten
kinds of programs that we know work, that it's something different. I'll go back to that. We know intensity and duration is very important, which is a minimum of 12 and a half hours a week, at least 30 weeks a year, developmentally appropriate activities, curricula, a whole bunch of other things. ECFE is primarily a parent and family education program that helps parents be the best parents they can be. And that's so critical, particularly when you have a newborn, 0, 1, 2, 3-year-olds. Many parents really struggle to try to figure out what they should be doing. And sometimes the only thing they have to go on is doing something different than what maybe they thought their parents did with their younger siblings. That's not good enough. And so that it's a totally different idea. Parents are our primary teachers. We want parents to go ahead and be having the information about what they can expect. You know, I used to work with pregnant and parenting teens, and one of the things that's a real challenge when you have teenage parents is that they don't abstract enough to know that when a three-month-old is crying that they're not trying to get back at them. But that's what they think when they're 15 years old or 16, yet another reason why we don't want kids having kids. But parents get good information, and because of the group work that's done, they get to get support from each other and learn about that they're not alone, and they develop strategies about how to be better parents. And the department, and certainly others here, as well as the early child family education, teachers themselves continually look for ways to be better doing what they're doing. And can we and should we be reaching out to more at-risk families? Yes. There's been talk, you know, we did the thing with grandparents being able to be connected. Child care providers would make a lot of sense. But that's really about foundational good information, and that's why it's also on a sliding fee. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things we could talk more about that I know we probably don't have time today. When you look at school readiness, it's essentially a funding stream right now. And one of the things that is trying to be addressed right now is what had the legislative auditor's report had come out with a couple years ago. The department and the school districts have been working on those. Because, again, we know what works. In all honesty, though, if you're getting at best $300 per kid that's coming through, we should question what we can really expect. And so, for example, and I was looking at the list, Nashwaukeewatin, and I know Senator Saxog's out of the room, they get like $9,000 a year for school readiness. There's not a lot one can do with $9,000 a year. Minneapolis gets about $863,000. But for a school district that size and with that many kids, that is not a whole lot of money either. I would argue at this point we are underfunding and perhaps not then being able to connect what the research is showing really works. We have some school districts that are able to combine this and other money to make that happen. The information that you got about Head Start, frankly, there's stuff that's all over the place, and I'd be more than happy to have a longer conversation with you because they have information within their own study that contradicts what they're saying. If we had some of the researchers from the U right now, what they would likely tell you is that you start seeing a decreased impact because of them catching up with other kids, but over time you do see a decreased prison population, you see more productive workforce. We don't have a huge amount of longitudinal studies, so we've only been able to do this over a handful. That's why I'm excited about what MELF is trying to do right now, because they are going to be doing some longitudinal work to be following some families. What we do know is in the last several years, I mean, not only does Head Start have to meet basically 1,800 performance standards that vary from things like make sure you've washed your hands after you go to the bathroom to some very specific things that deal with activities and kids. But they now have, in the last several years, have been doing assessment-based curricula, and they really have a much better idea, which is not reflected in there. One of the things that's a real challenge, I think, right now is we only get information when the kids come to elementary school. That's not good enough. If the child didn't know how to use a fork to begin with, or if they had a bunch of other challenges, but they have made a huge amount of progress, they've probably gotten a lot closer to closing that achievement gap for themselves than they would have in another setting. So I think you'd find, and perhaps, you know, I don't know if people have come and shown you what the different curricula have done and what the results they've been seeing on the pre-literacy and some of those other kinds of components, social, cognitive, small and large motor. But I think you'd find that the kids that have been participating in Head Start, especially in the last few years, are much further along from wherever they started, not necessarily as opposed to where my kids or your kids might have started, but from where they started. And they speak English. For the kids that didn't speak English when they started at a level, they certainly wouldn't have if they had started only in kindergarten. We see decreased use of paras. There's a whole bunch of other things to be looking at. So I know that we're about out of time, so maybe you and I need to have continue this conversation. But there really is, we are getting better information. But part of the reason why we want to do the quality rating system is that we want to be measuring results and be seeing the kinds of things that we should expect out of the programs.
Yeah, I think you're right, Senator Clark. I think we're about to be overrun with a lot of enthusiastic younger people.
And Mr. Chairman, just before we lift, I just would like clarification on the word entitlement that was inserted and also the link to the fiscal note, if that's something that can be.
Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, the way that I think the think about this word itself gets batted about. It's a fiscal term of art that indicates how much a formula would generate in a given fiscal year, but not actually how much is appropriated. That would be distinct from the appropriation, and this relates directly to the 90-10 payment schedule. So frequently we talk about the entitlement for a given fiscal year is, in this case, $10.3 million, but the appropriation would be 90% of that plus 10% from the prior year. So it's, I think there must be some feeling that, and I'm happy to visit with the department about this, that we need to actually state what the entitlement is, that must for some reason be missing, and on a technical basis we need to put it into the law.
Yeah, and I think Mr. Nauman and I had a discussion about that. I don't think it changes the, you know, when we talk about entitlement being kind of a program that has no beginning and or no end.
No end.
All right, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Clark, just because I need a little more background, does this bill restore us to a point where we were in 2002, or does it actually bring us up to where we should be by 2008?
Mr. Chair, it's
Senator Clark.
It restores the funds for ECFE to pre-allotment time. So what they were getting in 2002, 2003, and 2004, it does not account for inflation. And then as it relates to school readiness and Head Start, it's an additional $1 million. So one could argue it was a very tiny step forward.
Thank you, Senator Clark.
Right. Is there any other questions or anyone else that wants to comment on the bill? If not, Dr. Ephraim?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for this opportunity. I will be very brief.
Please give your name for the record.
Dr. Karen Ephraim with EdWatch. I just wanted to actually affirm what Senator Han was saying about Head Start, because since the program began in 1965, we have had $50 billion spent on 20 million children and over 600 studies, the most recent of which preliminary results of were given in 2005. And on measures of cognitive development, reading and writing, on socio-emotional development, on parenting skills, and on health, there were some improvements, but they were small or they were negligible, and they are detailed in that handout that I gave you. And even Dr. Ron Haskins, who's involved with the Annie Casey Foundation and involved in that study and a big proponent of Head Start, said that the results of this study are very disappointing as far as the impacts. So I would say that, and then I would also confirm what Senator Clark said about ECFE. According to the legislative auditor, it doesn't improve cognitive development. It does do some improvement on parenting, but if our goal is to do the to improve the achievement gap, that may not be the best use of resources. And finally, regarding kindergarten readiness, the legislative auditor has also found no great impact of that program, and home visiting doesn't improve child abuse rates nor the cognitive development of the child, and services can be very expensive, and there are also questions about consent and data collection and Fourth Amendment concerns that need to be dealt with. And just for 10 seconds, I wanted to mention on Senator Rummel's bill, the statute says that parents do not have to participate in screening or some components of it, and also that they are to be notified that they can get that from other providers. But I have three examples here of school districts that's including Chaska, which basically says the state of Minnesota requires that all children be screened before entering kindergarten, and this is a direct quote. I will leave you these examples. That is a huge concern as far as, again, consent and parental privacy. So thank you.
Dr. Ephraim, I'm not sure what the exact wording is. Is that children do have to be screened, but they don't have to be screened by the individual school district, I think. That's, I think, the way it should be explained.
Mr. Chairman, the issue is that these are coming on Wayzata, Chaska, and the Mapleton, St. Peter area, and they all say have to be screened. Don't mention anything about the opt-out. And this happened to me. This was in the information that I got for my child in the Wayzata School District. And the only reason I knew was because I knew the statute, but I, you know, that is not typical of all parents. And if you're raising the money with no requirement for the districts to truly notify their parents, that is a considerable problem. And I would ask for that to be considered as the bill moves forward. And I actually have some ideas on language if any senators are so inclined.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Dr. Ephraim. And I think, is there anyone else? Senator Clark, you want to make a motion that this be laid on the table?
Yes, sir.
Senator so Clark moves that Senate File 291 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Education Bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you. And members, remember, tomorrow evening at 6:07, which is right across the hall, and we'll be talking about special education. We have several bills that we'll be taking up. So, right, committee is adjourned.